From the Atlantic to the Pacific, across the islands of the Caribbean, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we're pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We've assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub in a wild world. So keep it tuned right here. Well, imagine, folks, being 40 years old and discovering that you are the direct descendant of one of history's most prolific and diabolical serial killers. Well, that is exactly what happened to my guest this hour when he discovered that his great-great-grandfather was H.H. Holmes, a man who may have killed over 200 people. There's no way of knowing. And he is most famous for what is considered his murder castle that was built in Chicago just in time for the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition. He built this hotel from the ground up as a masterpiece of torture and murder and experimentation. And he eventually was hanged for his crimes. He was born in 1861 and executed in 1896 when he was almost 35 years old. Well, my guest, of course, became fascinated with the history of his family, and but that's just the beginning of the story, because once he learned that he had this infamous killer's blood running through his veins, well, he then saw that maybe there was a connection to one of history's greatest mysteries to this day, the story of Jack the Ripper. It's all documented in his extremely popular book called Bloodstains. And in fact, you can go to bloodstainsthebook.com. It's linked up for you at speakingofstrange.com. So we are just delighted to have him with us on the hour of the program. His name is Jeff Mudgett. Jeff, welcome, sir, to Speaking of Strange.
Joshua, thank you so much. It's an honor and a pleasure to be on your show tonight. And I got to tell you, your description of what happened to me was perhaps the best I've heard yet of the hundreds of shows that I've been on.
Wow. Well, that is a huge compliment. And, well, you know, I had the honor of meeting you last year. We were both speakers at the Parahistory Con in upstate New York and ended up having dinner next to each other. And I was just riveted by your story, as I know everyone is who hears it. So let's get right to it. First off, just tell us, where are you from, Jeff, and where are you located tonight?
Yeah, I'm from California, and I'm in San Diego right now. But, okay. You know, we were a Navy family, Joshua. We moved around a lot, but we always came back to San Diego.
And so now tell us a little bit about the first 40 years of your life, what you did for a living, you know, what it was like before you learned this news and how that happened.
Yeah, I practiced law. I went to the University of San Diego School of Law, and I practiced law in California, did some criminal trials, practiced appellate court argument, and had a very successful legal practice, had a couple of small businesses, and then, as you so accurately described, had one night my grandfather revealed to the family his secret that he had kept from all of us, including my grandmother, about our great-great-grandfather, who was perhaps the most evil man that ever lived. When it's hard to say that because people immediately think of Hitler or Mao. Those names come up. But when I use the term most evil, I'm using that describing a man who did these things with his own hands. He didn't order soldiers to do them for him.
Wow. And so, and just so that everybody is certain, you know without a shadow of a doubt that you are, in fact, the direct descendant. There's no question about that, correct?
Oh, 100%. It's a great question, because when I first wrote the book, Ancestry.com challenged us as far as him being my great-great-grandfather, and we were almost ready to go to court over it, and then they finally backed down and admitted there was no doubt he is my great-great-grandfather.
Wow. Okay, so now, before we continue, for people who have never heard of H.H. Holmes before, there is a documentary, I presume it's presently at Netflix. His name pops up all the time in various documentaries, but give us sort of a brief overview of his absolutely amazing story.
Yeah, he was born, as you said, 1861 in New Hampshire. He lived in a small town called Gilmington, which I've visited twice, and still, which still holds the house that he was born and grew up in, where he went to church, where he taught elementary school before he left for Chicago. He grew bored. He married, had a small child, which was my great-grandfather. He grew bored. He left them alone there, went to Michigan, where he attended the University of Michigan School of Medicine and had one of the highest IQs ever recorded. This, you know, this is the evil genius. He then proceeded to Chicago, where he became fascinated with the upcoming World's Fair, where 10, 20, 30 million people from all over the world were going to attend. He set a plan in motion. When you discuss premeditation, his picture should be in the legal dictionaries, because here's a man who realized the fair was coming years ahead, went out and bought a piece of property which was where the transportation system from downtown Chicago was going to meet with the other line that would go out to the fair, and he planned and built a hotel there because he knew these millions of people would have to have a place to stay, and his pickings of these innocent victims would be perhaps the greatest chance he had to realize his infamous goals and experiments in longevity, in torture, and the experimentation of how human beings live under pressure, and that's what he did.
Wow. So now, when you learned that he was your great-great-grandfather, what was your immediate reaction to this? I mean, I would say that if I were in your position, one of the first things that would occur to me is, wow, I have this blood flowing in my own veins. How did that change your own self-perception?
Yeah, you know, my first reaction was what the rest of the family did. We all wanted to deny. We wanted to run away from the facts. But it wouldn't leave me after, you know, I heard the secret come out. And it started bothering me. It started affecting my career. It started affecting my relationship with my wife. And I decided, Joshua, that I wasn't going to be another Mudgett that ran away and hid, which is what the family did after the trial in the 1890s. They all moved out to California to get away from the stigma. I decided that wasn't going to be me, that the best way to, well, meet my destiny, which is what I thought it was to come up with the facts and the truth. Because the more I dug into this story, Joshua, the more I realized that the previous authors, historians, were all wrong, and so much of the story was just, well, untrue, error, or just made up. And I wanted to be the one that came with the I wanted to rewrite history, and that's what I decided to do. I quit my career. I set aside everything. I traveled the country to every site I could find that had anything to do with H.H. Holmes and wrote the book.
So what are some of the most surprising things that you discovered when you went back and got as close as possible to the facts?
I would say when I attended the post office in Englewood, which is where the murder castle was, and we got permission from the U.S. government to go into that basement, which the employees there all believed was haunted. They didn't use the basement. Imagine that. Here's the United States government post office, which barricades the basement because they're afraid to go down the steps. Well, I write about this in the book, going down into that basement. And when History Channel filmed me going down into the basement the second time, I told them what had happened to me that first time. I had opened that door, moved aside the cobwebs, and I'm not kidding, cobwebs, looked down those steps, and I wasn't a religious man. I didn't believe in the paranormal. I didn't believe in supernatural. And in 1 hour, Joshua, all those things changed because of the energy I felt in that basement. And I'm convinced that if we have the right people with the funds behind us to do it properly, to do it scientifically, I'm convinced that that location down those steps will be where energy after death is going to be, where we prove that that exists. And I'm convinced of that.
Wow. You know, honestly, you just gave me goosebumps just imagining what that moment was like, stepping into that environment, literally a tomb. And when you started your research and when you dug this deep and you started having that kind of access, did you feel like any of this started following you around?
You know, that's probably... When people buy my book, Joshua, some are disappointed that it's not just a recreation of The Devil in the White City, the great book by Eric Larson about H.H. Holmes, the history of Chicago, that. Bloodstains is about how this knowledge and my learning the truth affected my life and my beliefs about what life's all about, and having this thing, this perhaps, you know, the greatest monster that ever lived, start following me around, where I was beginning to hear voices in my head, which neurologists told me was epilepsy, and I would suffer these seizures, and then I would see and hear Dr. Holmes and my arguments with those doctors that, wait a minute. I understand how epilepsy works. I understand seizures. I understand how the mind can play those games on a victim of that illness. But how did I know these facts that I had never heard of before? And when I went back and verified them, Joshua, they were true. They were true. And I couldn't have known that. I had no previous knowledge unless the voice in my head had given me something concrete. So When I started having those feelings, having those, well, that history of those facts become verified and true, I knew that there was more than just writing a book and trying to sell copies to make a little money and make a living. This was something that was going to outlive me long after I had passed myself, and that gave me the momentum and motion to do it right, and I think I really have.
All right, we're going to take a break right there. When we come back, we will continue hearing the amazing journey that Jeff Mudgett has gone on. And yes, it's leading, my friends, to Jack the Ripper. He's the author of Bloodstains. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Stick around for more on Speaking of Strange. Yeah, it's the program where the unusual becomes usual. Keeping you company tonight, I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's called Speaking of Strange. Tonight's program is brought to you by Wright's Coin Shop in Asheville, North Carolina. And you may and you should call Wright's Coin Shop at 828-298-5402. Again, that's 828-298-5402. My guest this hour is Jeff Mudgett. He is the author of the book Bloodstains, and the website for Bloodstains is bloodstainsthebook.com. It's linked up for you at speakingofstrange.com, and Jeff Mudgett is the direct descendant of H.H. Holmes, the prolific American serial killer. His real name was Herman Webster Mudgett. So it makes sense that my guest name is Jeff Mudgett. And by the way, for those of you who know that I will be appearing at the Michigan Paracon 6, August 7th and 8th in Sault Ste. Marie, well, you should also know that Jeff Mudgett will be there. And Jeff, you just said during the break you're going to do something really interesting during your program. Would you mind repeating that?
Oh, I'd be glad to. My friends Tim Ellis and Brad Blair, the managers of the event, they watched my video of the TED asked me to talk in Vancouver this last year, and I was given 15 minutes to basically conduct a grand jury, present the evidence to the audience that H.H. Holmes was Jack the Ripper, and then poll the audience after I was finished to see if they agreed that we had probable cause and that a trial for murder should have been conducted with Holmes as Jack the Ripper. Well, when we conducted that poll, we had 77% of the 4,000 people were there vote yes, that he was guilty. So when Tim and Brad watched that TED video, they contacted me and asked if I'd be willing to do that at their event, and they'd give me a full hour, which, as you know, prosecuting a grand jury with 15 minutes isn't enough time with all the evidence that I have. So I'm very much looking forward to doing the same grand jury presentation, but with a lot more time so that we can present the evidence in a more thorough fashion and manner.
Oh, well, that is going to be a classic program. So I know everybody who's going to be there at the Michigan Paracon 6 is going to be stuffing into that room. And, okay, before we get to the Jack the Ripper connection, you told me a story in New York that really just, again, it was one of these things that sent a chill down my spine. When you were researching H.H. Holmes, your great-great-grandfather, you found an incident in which if he had murdered a woman after he impregnated her, you would not be around right now. Tell us that story, Jeff.
Yeah, it's probably the most profound piece of the story of my life. I found some writings that Holmes had done while he was in prison awaiting his trial and the execution, which we can talk about later. I don't believe ever occurred, and we're going to prove that one day. But back to your point, he had written about, he had asked my great-great-grandmother for a divorce. And as you know, back in those days, a divorce was a very serious matter. It wasn't just thrown around like it is today, sadly. And she refused him. Well, he went from Chicago on the train. He went up to New Hampshire. He knocked on the door. He asked her for the divorce. She refused again. And he wrote about standing out on the sidewalk, Joshua, for 3 or 4 hours, staring at the house, trying to make his mind up what to do. And when your listeners realize this is the man that they invented the term serial killer for and psychotic. You know what was going through his mind out there, and you can imagine my great-great-grandmother looking through the drapes out the window and seeing him out on the sidewalk, just being terrified. Well, he allowed them to live. He walked off, and he never revisited either her or his son. And that son was my grandfather's father. And as you mentioned, if Holmes had done what he normally did and did hundreds of times after that, I wouldn't be here talking with you right now.
Wow. What a profound concept. I mean, just mentally being able to travel back in time and see this incident, this single, you know, incident that would have just changed the world in many, many ways. All right, let's move on to this absolutely amazing epiphany that you had about the connection between H.H. Holmes and Jack the Ripper. How did this first occur to you?
When I was researching Holmes, and to tell you the truth, I didn't have any idea that Jack the Ripper was connected in any way. I was contacted by a man named Mark Potts from Philadelphia, who had spent 20 years of his life researching the possibility that Holmes was Jack the Ripper. When he first told me, when he first called me, Joshua, I didn't believe this. I thought it was another kook that you meet when you're into subjects like Holmes. I meet a lot of them at the events I go to. I blew it off. He kept at me, and then one day he sent me a letter that he had received from the British Library. And the British Library is much like the Smithsonian in London. They're very, very, they're taken very seriously. And they had taken the evidence that Mark had submitted to them and run it by their expert of handwriting, who conclusively stated that the Dear Boss letter had been written by H.H. Holmes. And anyone that studies Jack the Ripper, any Ripperologist listening, they'll know immediately what I'm referring to when you say the Dear Boss letter. That's the most famous letter. That's the letter that Scotland Yard and the London Metropolitan believe was written by Jack the Ripper. Well, having practiced law in California, knowing handwriting expert opinions are not very strong there, and they can be, you can get a yes, you can get a no on the same piece of, in the same document. I knew that the Supreme Court had ruled them inadmissible on criminal trials. So I did some background. I went and contacted the FBI and the Postal Service, and they forwarded me on to the University of Buffalo, where a corporation there was specializing in creating a computer program that would do the handwriting with enough accuracy that would be admissible in court in criminal trials. Well, when I contacted them, they were excited as all get out, as you can imagine, to be able to take part in comparing the Holmes letters with this Dear Boss letter. They ran it through their machine, and their machine, Joshua, basically has a million points on each letter, comparing two different pieces, two different documents and the handwriting on each. If they're given enough time, they can guarantee the accuracy of their conclusion. Well, they came back to me with 97% certitude that Holmes was the author of the Dear Boss letter.
All right, well, let's stop right there for a second, because this is really, really fascinating, and we got to take another break. When we come back, though, we're going to continue down this line, and I want all of you listening to realize, when we come back, Jeff's going to explain to us how the H.H. Holmes, his great-great-grandfather, was able to travel to London and become the figure that we now know as Jack the Ripper. He's the author of the book Bloodstains. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange.
Thank you.
It's the show where the unusual becomes usual. Thanks for joining us tonight. I am your host, Joshua P. Warren, and you are listening to Speaking of Strange, brought to you by Wright's Coin Shop. Again, the number to Wright's, write it down, 828-298-5402. You can call them from anywhere in the country, 828-298-5402. You'll also find a link at speakingofstrange.com. And while you're there, certainly click the link to bloodstainsthebook.com. Bloodstains is the book by my guest, Jeff Mudgett. And we are talking about the journey that he has taken. He, of course, learned that he is the direct descendant of H.H. Holmes. And as he followed the trail of facts, it led him to Jack the Ripper. So let's get back to the story. How did your great-great-grandfather, the American serial killer, end up becoming Jack the Ripper, Jeff?
Well, most people don't realize, Joshua, that the transportation systems at the time were excellent. And Holmes was a very, very wealthy man who loved travel. We have letters, him writing letters to his lawyers from Berlin, from Paris. We have one he wrote from London a couple of years after the Ripper murders. But there were steamships that you would take from New York and travel to Southampton 7, 8, 9 days. Holmes would buy a first-class ticket. He would have his steward with him. He would eat the caviar, the champagne. He would tell stories to the beautiful young girls on the ships. And there was little problem whatsoever. We think we know exactly what ship he rode over on. We know what day he stepped off in the UK. And we have the shipping line. We found out they still have the passenger list, Joshua. And when I get a little bit more horsepower from shows like yours and from people stopping just straight denying that Holmes could have been Jack the Ripper, when they start believing my evidence, we get a little money behind this. We're going to go get that passenger list in London, and then we're going to run the entire list through the computer system at the University of Buffalo, because Holmes used at least 31 different aliases. And to do a comparison of that passenger list to find the one he used for that trip is a lot of money. I mean, we're talking a lot of money. And when I get that money behind me to further the investigation, we'll be able to prove to the world exactly what ship he rode over on.
And so now he, of course, he was a doctor. He was a surgeon. How long do you think he was there? And you know, what relationship is there between his known victims and what Jack the Ripper did?
There has never been any study or any reports about his victims at the murder castle. Most people are surprised, Joshua, to know that there wasn't ever a trial or any investigation by the police into the identity of those victims. So comparing, I get that question quite often, comparing his M.O. in Chicago at the murder castle with the M.O. in London by the Ripper is very difficult and probably erroneous, because you're talking about a doctor, a surgeon, that would have assistants helping him with a victim in his basement of his hotel, taking as much time as he wanted to conducting these horrible experiments. Now, the Ripper murders were conducted in the fog at night in 4 or 5 minutes time max. So to compare M.O.s to say they're not the same man, I think it's off on the wrong track.
So what makes you feel psychologically would drive him to do that, to do something that is so different than what he was used to, being in complete control in America?
Now you're getting into a very difficult subject, which I've spelled out in conjecture, and I've tried to give an opinion on. But the more, Joshua, I learn about this man with this IQ that puts him up in Einstein's range, you know, we all have to know our limitations. And for me to think I can think with him is way over the track. So
right.
I put together some ideas and some opinions, which I spell out in the book for my readers to make their own minds up. But it has to do with in my belief, longevity. The man wanted to learn how to live forever. He believed it had to do with female hormones in their reproductive systems and their organs. And when you go through the pathology reports, Joshua, of the Ripper murders, the first three at least, those doctors were convinced that whoever committed those murders was not only knowledgeable in medicine and anatomy, but was a practiced surgeon, because he removed in those short minutes organs without damaging the bordering organs in those cavities, the body cavities. And when I've conducted interviews of practicing surgeons now, asking them their opinion, they firmly believe they couldn't have done it themselves in that short amount of time. It had to be someone who had practiced removing these organs 10, 20, 30, 100 times. And now we get down to the fact that it probably has to be H.H. Holmes who was Jack the Ripper.
In fact, if listeners go to bloodstainsthebook.com, you have a graphic there showing a photo of H.H. Holmes that sort of dissolves into a sketch of what was described as Jack the Ripper. Tell us a bit more about that graphic, please.
You mean the computer composite of his face?
Yes, exactly.
That was done in 2006 by the BBC and Scotland Yard. See, Joshua, most people don't understand that there were 13 eyewitnesses to what Jack the Ripper looked like. And those were held by the London Metropolitan Police, then the Scotland Yard. Well, like I say, in 2006, the BBC paid for that composite to be made. Well, when we saw that composite, Mark Potts and I, we have a profile picture of Holmes, which we both scratched our head and said, you know, that's way too close. So we ran that photo of Holmes up against that composite, and we took it to the FBI, and they gave me the name of a retired officer who had done that for a living, comparing composites with photographs. He said it was the closest he'd ever seen, and he showed me how to compare a photo with a composite to do it properly. And you look at the nose, you look at the ear, you look at the eyelids, you look at the lips. And if any of your readers go to my website, we put that up, and they can look for themselves. And it's amazing how close it is.
So now, of course, when you read something basic like the Wikipedia article, it says here that he confessed to 27 murders, of which 9 were confirmed. His actual body count could be over 200. Do you have a sense of how many people that he killed based upon your research?
I think it's over 1,000. And
wow.
What most people, when we dig into the history and the facts, Josh, we came up with, not only did he have a furnace in the basement to get rid of the waste after he had murdered these innocents, but then we found out he owned a glass factory in Chicago, Joshua, a huge glass factory that never sold any glass. And if you know anything about glass, to manufacture glass, you have to have temperatures so high to melt the sand to come up with the glass. I'm not an expert. I'm not a scientist in making glass. But I do know that the temperatures that they needed at that factory were enough to eliminate human waste after murders. We then learned that he had a barge company along the Chicago River, which would go out and dump concrete blocks into the bottom of the river late at night. Well, he never did any commercial work building Chicago or any of the streets or skyscrapers, any of those things. All he did was had a barge go out and dump these blocks off in the river. So when people ask me how many he murdered, I think we have perhaps the most heinous murdering machine ever. And those numbers that we hear, continually hear, are very hard to deal with. And I'll give you an example. That 27 number that you brought up from Wikipedia, that was a number Holmes gave to a reporter for the New York Times. He gave him that about 6 days before the alleged execution. The day before the hanging, Holmes admitted that was a lie. It wasn't true at all. He just made it up.
Well, you know, we've got a couple minutes before our next break. Now, so you are saying you don't think that he was executed? Is that right?
No, and that's perhaps the most fascinating, besides him being Jack the Ripper, that's perhaps the most fascinating aspect of the story. And one, Joshua, when we come back, I can explain to you, we will be able to prove 100% that he was never executed. And that's just another question of money when I get that behind me, and I'll explain how we're going to do it.
Okay, well, you know, we have about a minute. Go ahead and let's get started on this. What makes you think that he wasn't executed?
Okay. The New York Times, after the alleged execution, started writing about something called the Holmes Curse. Eric Larson wrote about it in The Devil in the White City, and I write about it in Bloodstains. The judge, the prosecutor, the jury foreman, the experts that came and testified against him at his trial all started showing up dead or disappearing or having terrible misfortune in their life. And we're not talking about four or five people, Joshua. We're talking about as many as 40 people that were involved in his arrest, the trial, and alleged execution that had these terrible misfortunes occur.
Okay. All right. So great place to pause. When we come back, we will dig deeper into this during our last segment of this hour. It's flown by way too quickly. I knew it would. I had never heard anybody say that H.H. Holmes wasn't executed. We'll get the rest of that story when we return. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You are listening to the show where the unusual becomes usual. Speaking of strange.
Delia, oh Delia, Delia all my life. If I hadn't shot poor Delia, I'd have had her for my wife. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone. I went up to Memphis, and I met Delia there. Found her in her parlor, and I tied her to her chair. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone. She was low down and trifling, and she was cold and mean. Kind of evil make me want to grab my submachine. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone. First time I shot her in the side. Hard to watch her suffer, but with the second shot she died. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone. But jailer, oh jailer, jailer, I can't sleep. Cause all around my bedside I hear the patter of Delia's feet. Delia's gone, one more round, Delia's gone.
And we are in the final minutes of hour number two on tonight's Speaking of Strange. Coming up next hour, well, we call it the Dark 30 Hour, and that's when we dig into some of the more outrageous and controversial news stories. Not for the kiddies, not for the easily offended. That's why we save it for late at night, so stick around for that if it sounds like your cup of tea. Right now, unfortunately, wrapping up this fascinating conversation with Jeff Mudgett, author of Bloodstains. And, again, his website is Bloodstains the Book. That's the good news. You can go there and buy the book. But he is constantly learning new things about this case. So, gosh, we have about 5 minutes, Jeff. Let's talk about, you know, getting back to why you think he wasn't executed and new revelations.
Yeah, let me finish off. About 2 weeks ago, Joshua, once we established the handwriting as he had written Dear Boss, the Ripperologist, when I'd go do events, they'd give me the normal, okay, you've proven he wrote the letter, but that doesn't prove he's the killer. You prove he's the author, which, as a practicing attorney in criminal law, they had a point. Well, about 2 weeks ago, we came up with one of the original posters from 1888 that the London Metropolitan Police had attacked onto the walls in the area of the murders, asking for help from the citizens there, identifying this horrible killer. And on this poster is the Dear Boss letter with the envelope that was used, that the killer used to mail to the media, that he sent to the paper, that he sent the letter to. And at the bottom of this poster, Joshua, is the London Metropolitan Police stating, listen, if you recognize this handwriting, you need to contact us. Who wrote this letter is the killer. They state this, which pretty much blows the doors off that argument that the Ripperologists were using. Because here's the London Metropolitan Police, 2 days after Catherine Eddowes' murder, stating that for a fact, these police officers and investigators believe the author of that letter was the murderer. So we're going to present that piece of evidence for the first time in August at the Michigan show. So you'll get to see it, Joshua.
Oh, yes. I cannot wait. That's going to be awesome. All right. So, well, you're making a hell of an airtight case here. And so now let me ask you this. If he wasn't executed, how did he slip away and what happened to him?
You know, when I found out about that Holmes curse and how serious it was, I started going back and look at the procedures used when he was allegedly hanged. I took it backwards, Joshua, which is the way a good prosecutor does a case. So we worked it backwards, and we started looking at the strange idiosyncrasies involved, how when he came off the scaffolding, the body went into a coffin, which was immediately filled with concrete so that no one could inspect the body. He paid the judge so that the judge would not require a pathology after the hanging, which was required by law. He then hired Pinkerton guards to monitor the coffin while it was taken to the graveyard, where a 10-foot hole was dug, which was then filled with concrete. Every step of the way, including him being able to use a hood when he was hanged, which was against Philadelphia law, every step of the way, the man had used his money to create a method which would have been unable to establish identity. So when we kept putting those facts together, I came up with the conclusion that it wasn't him at all, and that as soon as we have the backing, we're going to dig up that concrete. We know exactly where his grave is allegedly, where he was allegedly buried. We're going to dig up that concrete. We're going to open up that cement. The Smithsonian's going to take possession of the remains, and then they're going to do a comparison of the DNA with my tissue, and we'll be able to prove 100% whether that was him or not.
Wow. Oh, the things to look forward to. I, as you know, if there's anything that I can do or any of my listeners can do to help with this process, I think you can rest assured we'll be more than happy to do it. Your story is just absolutely incredible, and you have done the best possible job of telling it. You're just a fascinating man. I'm just honored to have met you, and I'm looking forward to spending some time there seeing you in Michigan. I want everybody to go to bloodstainsthebook.com, bloodstainsthebook.com, and as you know, I'm already looking forward to some fantastic movie or TV series or something that inevitably will come from all of this profound work that you have done. So, Jeff, I know you'll keep up the good work, and thank you so much for being on Speaking of Strange tonight.
You know, Joshua, thank you very much, and efforts like yours and the hard work you do allowing me to voice my opinion and the facts on your show are helping me to rewrite history, and I got to tell you, without you and others like you, I wouldn't be able to do it. Thank you very much.
My honor. Okay, folks, there you have it. Jeff Mudgett, the author of Bloodstains. What a story, huh? When we come back, yes, it will be time for the Dark 30 Hour. I am Joshua P. Warren. Stick around for that on Speaking of Strange.